Morning, everyone. Reaching Christ's name this morning. It's a blessing to be able to be here again. It's the first time I've traveled away from home to bring a message. So it's kind of a new thing, and I'm a little nervous. But it's good to be here, and I'm just glad we have the Bible to go by and to preach from, and it's not my own words. If it was, you probably wouldn't want to hear it. Well, can you come worship with us more? I wish we'd see more of each other. We're only 2.5 hours away, but seems like we don't get back and forth enough, so welcome that way. I was, first when I was planning to come up here, I thought I would just probably preach a message that I had preached before, and figured I knew what it would be, and kind of going with that. So fairly recent. It often come to me that maybe that's not what I'm supposed to do. And I guess I was given a burden to preach something that I haven't preached before, so I had to dig. And that's what I'm going to do here this morning, and I hope it all makes sense and you can stay with me. And I'm going to try and bring something new. There's probably nothing you haven't heard before. But it did me great to do a study of this story that I'm going to talk about. And I hope we can draw some parallels and some truths for us today out of it. You know, the end of that theme verse in our Sunday school, I said the devil knows that his time is short. And that verse was written a long time ago, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. If the devil knew his time was short back then, what is he doing now? If he thought he had to ratchet up the pressure back then, how about now? And it goes along with a little bit the burden that I had this morning. First off, I'm going to read a little story here. I like to keep the children on board, and it's maybe something that, here again, you've all heard before. But it goes along with what I want to talk about this morning. It says, the goal was ambitious. Public interest was high. Experts were eager to contribute. Money was readily available. Armed with every ingredient for success, Samuel Pierpont Langley set out in the early 1900s to be the first man to pilot an airplane. Highly regarded, he was a senior officer in the Smithsonian Institution, a mathematics professor who had also worked at Harvard. His friends included some of the most powerful men in government and business, including Andrew Carnegie and Alexander Graham Bell. Langley was given a $50,000 grant from the War Department to fund his project. A tremendous amount of money for the time, he pulled together the best minds of the day, a veritable team, dream team of talent and know-how. Langley and his team used the finest materials, and the press followed him everywhere. People all over the country were riveted to the story, waiting to read that he had achieved his goal. With a team he had gathered and ample resources, his success was guaranteed. Or was it? A few hundred miles away, Wilbur and Orville Wright were working on their own flying machine. Their passion to fly was so intense that it inspired the enthusiasm and commitment of a dedicated group in their hometown of Dayton, Ohio. There was no funding for their venture, no government grants, no high-level connections. Not a single person on the team had an advanced degree or even a college education, not even Wilbur or Orville, but the team banded together in a humble bicycle shop and made their vision real. On December 17, 1903, a small group witnessed a man take flight for the first time in history. How did the Wright brothers succeed where a better equipped, better funded, better educated team could not. It wasn't luck. Both the Wright brothers and Langley were highly motivated. Both had a strong work ethic. Both had keen scientific minds. They were pursuing exactly the same goal, but only the Wright brothers were able to inspire those around them and truly lead their team to develop a technology that would change the world. Only the Wright brothers started with why. They had a reason, they had a purpose that the other competitor, Samuel Pierpont Langley, did not have. And that is a question, is probably the most important question we can ask today, is why. And there's a reason that when a child is developing and they're 1, 2, 3, 4 years old, that question comes all the time. Why do you do this? Why do you do that? If you ask them to do something, they need to know why, to the extent you have to put an end to it sometimes. But it is a very important question, and I pulled some of these thoughts out of a book that I read. I love to read, and the book is written by Simon Sinek, is the author, and he, the name of the book was Start With Why, and that kind of grabbed my attention, and he comes at it from a business perspective, not religious at all that I know of, but it really resonated with me. Why, his thing is, why do you run a business? You sell your why. You sell why you do something more than what you sell. And I just had to compare it with the Christian life. Why do we do what we do? Why do you do what we do? And I'm just going to read another little excerpt from his book here. And he's talking more to leadership here, but he says, someone to motivate a purchase decision. Others are looking for support or a vote. Still others are keen to motivate the people around them to work harder or smarter just to follow the rules. The ability to motivate people is not in itself difficult. It is usually tied to some external factor. Tempting incentives or the threat of punishment will often elicit the behavior we desire. General Motors, for example, so successfully motivated people to buy their products, they sold more cars than any other automaker in the world for over 77 years. Though they were leaders in their industry, they did not lead. Great leaders, in contrast, are able to inspire people to act. Those who are able to inspire give people a sense of purpose or belonging that has little to do with any external incentive or benefit to be gained. Those who truly lead are able to create a following of people who act not because they were swayed, but because they were inspired. For those who are inspired, the motivation to act is deeply personal. They are less likely to be swayed by incentives. Those who are inspired are willing to pay a premium or endure inconvenience, even personal suffering. Those who are able to inspire will create a following of people, supporters, voters, customers, workers, who act for the good of the whole, not because they have to, but because they want to. So relatively few in number, the organizations and leaders with the natural ability to inspire us come in all shapes and sizes. They can be found in both the public and the private sectors. They are in all sorts of industries, selling to consumers or to other businesses. Regardless of where they exist, they all have a disproportionate amount of influence in their industries. They have the most loyal customers and the most loyal employees. They tend to be more profitable than others in their industry. They are more innovative, and most importantly, they're able to sustain all things over the long term. All these things over the long term, many of them change industries. Some of them even change the world. And he has some examples of that. The Wright brothers, Dr. King Jr., the Southwest Airlines, John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, there were men that inspired change. They didn't demand it. It says, regardless of size or industry, they all think, act, and communicate exactly alike. And it's complete opposite of everyone else. What if we could all learn to think, act, and communicate like those who inspire? I imagine a world in which the ability to inspire is practiced not just by a chosen few, but by the majority. Studies show that over 80% of Americans do not have their dream job. If more knew how to build organizations that inspire, we would live in a world in which that statistic was the reverse. A world in which over 80% of people love their jobs. People who love going to work are more productive and more creative. They go home happier, and they have happier families. They treat their colleagues, clients, customers better. Inspired employees make for stronger companies and stronger economies. That is why I wrote this book. I hope to inspire others to do the things that inspire them so that together we may build the companies, the economy, and a world in which trust and loyalty are norm and not the exception. This book is not designed to tell you what to do or how to do it. Its goal is not to give you a course of action. Its goal is to offer you the cause of the action. You say, what does that have to do with anything in the Bible? Well, I guess we'll see. The title of my message this morning is there not a cause? And that's the phrase that came to me last week. I've been thinking a lot about just the cause and why we do what we do. And I guess it's a bit of a burden I've had over the years. You think about the military and how does a military recruit young, strong, able-bodied, confident men? How do they recruit them and retain them so far as to give their lives for something? And it's a question I've had as you study that, and the only thing I come up with is they keep a cause. They keep something to fight for out ahead, and they present that cause as worth dying for, and they teach that, and they train for that, and many of them shed their blood for whatever cause that is. In America, it's freedom. There's a little, I want to write up on the board here. There was a study done, and maybe some of you have seen it, but name is Alexander Fraser Tytler. It's called the Tytler Cycle of Freedom. And I'll just draw that up on the board here so you can see it. This Alexander Fraser Tytler studied. He was a professor, an advocate, a judge, and a historian. He was a professor of universal history, and he studied history, and he said every democracy goes through this cycle. It starts with bondage. There's a revival or spiritual faith is born from bondage. We go to courage. We find freedom, liberty, brings abundance, which brings people have a lot. They tend to selfishness. Selfishness tends to complacency. Complacency to apathy, back to dependence, and back to bondage. He said, it is proven over and over, once that cycle is started, it has to continue. And where are we in that? Where is America in that? I'll let you make your own evaluations of that, but I thought it was really interesting. And we can see how it works. It's so obvious all around us. So is there not a cause? Let's turn to 1 Samuel 17. And it's the story of David and Goliath. And here again, I'm going to read a fair bit of this. I didn't know where to start and stop, but I love reading this story anytime. So I thought I'll just read down through most of this. We'll begin in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 17. It says, "And Jesse said unto David his son, Take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to thy brethren, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their thousand, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran to the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked to them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words. And David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, So shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, Why camest thou hither, and with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. And David said, What have I now done? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another and spake after the same manner unto the people, and the people answered him again after the former manner. When words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight this Philistine. And Saul said to David, Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And he went out after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, Moreover, the Lord hath delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, and he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, Go, and the Lord be with thee. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put an helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook, and he put them in his shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and unto the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give thy carcasses to the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the world may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And it came to pass, when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag, and he took thence a stone, and he slung it, and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him, but there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof, and slew him, and cut off his head therewith. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and of Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way in Shearim, and even unto Gath and unto Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the hosts, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, As thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. And the king said, Inquire thou whose son the stripling is. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, Whose son art thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. There's a lot to glean out of that story, and I don't know if it ever gets boring to me to read through that account. There's so much you can pull from it, but I wanted to look at a few things this morning. David had a cause, and I have three things I want to look at: awakening the cause, accepting the cause, and advancing the cause. First, we'll look at awakening the cause in verse 26. Says, for who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Verse 25 I want to look at. There's a slight difference in what David said to what the soldiers in the army of Israel said, how they perceived Goliath. In verse 25, says, and the men of Israel said, Have ye seen this man that is come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And what was David's comment on that? In David's mind, he was not only defying Israel, he was defying the armies of the living God. And it's a slight difference in perception. What was the difference that made David enter that fight that the other soldiers that stood there for 40 days and listened to this racket, they had put up with that, and every time it happened, they would fall apart. I think it was the fact that David seen the armies of the living God and the soldiers, David's own brother and King Saul, only seeing the army of Israel that they were defending. And as I thought of that, and the cause, and me growing up through my youth, and I'm not that old, I don't have that much experience, but What is the cause that was put forth to us through those years, so through those times of the battle? And not that I'm out of them, we're definitely in them yet, but are we a part of a Mennonite church? Say, yeah, we are. Do we defend the Mennonite church? Sure we do. Well, does it make a difference if it's the Church of the Living God or the Church of Jesus Christ and we identify as Mennonites? Is there a slight difference there that will make us go that extra step to keep that cause forward in our mind, that the cause that is over and above the church? There's just a slight difference in perception. Some other example to that, a slight difference in perception. When you walk across a field, do you see dirt or do you see soil? Some see dirt and some see soil, and there is a little difference, in a slight difference in the perception there. Soil is full of life and biology, and it is the sustenance. Without soil, we couldn't survive. You can see that or you can see dirt. When you're in town or going through the city, do you see people or do you see souls? It's a slight difference in perception that will affect our action or lack thereof. So as this cause is awakened, so is the conflict. David recognized the giant. He recognized exactly what the giant was doing, more so than defying the armies of Israel. He was defying the God of Israel. And he knew he had to do something. And it's interesting to me, we think about David fighting Goliath, and he did. He won that battle. But there was a battle that took place before Goliath that a lot of times I've read over and never really thought about. Look at verse 28. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down, and that thou mightest see the battle. In my own words, David came in there. And let's put ourselves back in that situation just a little bit. These soldiers had been facing off for 40 days. Over a month, they had, as far as we know, they had been there and this had gone on. And they never had what it took to step in. Not a single soldier in the host, in the Israeli army had what it took to step forward and give it a shot. David comes in there, and David's own brother, David comes in kind of out of nowhere, and he sees the situation from a different perspective, and he wants to do something about it. And the first enemy he had to face was his own brother. He's like, what are you doing here, you arrogant little runt? Where did you come from? Where did you leave the sheep? And David had to, I've just wondered how the story would read if David would have cowered at that point in time and slunk out of there and never fought that giant. But David leveled with him right there. And it was his older brother. David was the youngest brother. And I can see him standing there looking at Eliab in the eye. He was probably just as tall as Eliab was at that point. And he said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And then he turned to the men that were around him. He said, is there not a cause? Like, don't you see it? And so often that is exactly how it happens. These soldiers were standing there for 40 days, pandering and cowering in fear of the giant. And when somebody stepped in and wanted to do something about it and make a move, they attacked him because he didn't fit what they thought would overcome this giant. I pulled a quote from Matthew Henry's commentary that I thought fit very well. It says, in times of general formality and lukewarmness, every degree of zeal which implies readiness to go further or to venture more in the cause of God than others will be blamed as pride and ambition, and by none more than near relations like Eliab or negligent superiors. And I thought of that, and I'll have to say, I have personally experienced some of that exact thing. I am not anywhere close to what David was doing. But when you have to, when the first battle is in an outreach effort or an honest effort to just further the work of Christ, if the first battle is someone that should be standing there supporting and helping, it's quite something to deal with. But David related right. He calmly answered, and then he made his move. There's another story that came to mind when I read over this, and I don't know if you've ever heard of the name Desmond Doss. I'm sure that many of you have, but he was in the Second World War. He was a medic in the Second World War, very religious, and the name of the book is Redemption at Hacksaw Ridge, but he came in, he enlisted and he came in, but he refused to carry a gun. And he made it into the army, and he said he was there to heal and not to kill. And he absolutely would not touch a weapon at all. For the first while, he was belittled by everybody, all the soldiers and his, everybody made fun of him. He'd kneel down to pray, and they'd throw stuff at him and harass him. Slowly over the years, he did gain a little bit of credibility. They started to like him a little bit. And then there was the battle on Hacksaw Ridge where they came under intense attack, and they were up on a cliff. And they started to retreat over that cliff, but they were under such intense attack, they took a lot of casualties. They took a lot of hits. And Desmond Doss was up there administering first aid, and he would give it to anybody. He would give it to the enemy soldier that was laying there kneeling, and he didn't care. He seen it as a human life. He seen it as a soul, and he would reach out to them no matter what. He single-handedly, they retreated down off that cliff. He stayed up there working, and he single-handedly rescued around 75 wounded men, drug them to the edge of the cliff, and he had a special knot harness that he made up, and he lowered him down over the cliff to the waiting army that was down there to take him. He had a cause, and that's what I'd like to bring out. That cause was awakened in his life, and he lived by that. He seen way beyond just the battle that he was facing that day. Next, I want to look at accepting the cause. Verse 32. David said, "Thy servant will go and fight this Philistine." So he recognized the cause. It was awakened, and he decided to do something about it. He made the choice. Don't worry. give me a chance, I'll look after it. And here again, I'd like to go down to verse 36. David brings it out again. Saul was skeptical. He was telling Saul, I'll go and fight this Philistine, don't worry. David went back to his cause at the end of verse 36. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. There it is again. David, it was that perception of the cause that made David able to face Goliath. Finally, Saul said, go, and the Lord be with thee. And we got to realize here where Saul was in his journey. He was a failed leader of Israel. His kingdom had been basically taken from him. And he was the leader of that army that was standing back there in fear, unable to move forward and fight this giant. And there again, how much more should we today be able to face the giants that we are asked to face? Romans 8, verse 37 says, nay, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. We have the promise over and over again that we will have. The power is there. Everything's there to fight your battles and to win your battles. 100%, you can do it. Jesus Christ and his kingdom are the cause that we are called to defend. And if that is the over everything, if we can see through our business and our families and our church and our beyond all that to the cause of Christ, that is what it will take to motivate us as the Satan ramps up his, as the Goliaths get more frequent and more intense and bigger. That is the only thing that's going to make us able to look forward and fight that giant and succeed. And now we want to look at advancing the cause. In verse 40. And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook. And he put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in the scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. He started to move. And notice here, he was very careful. The stones he chose. He prepared himself. He was careful. He had tried on the armor. He had taken it off because it didn't feel right. And he had used what he had at hand and what he was used to using to his advantage. And you can imagine that he came walking out across that valley. He had chosen his stones, and the face-off was coming, and this young, wiry, young guy walking across there with zero armor on, visibly. It must have looked ridiculous. The army of Israel standing back here, all their armor and their swords and everything to do it. Philistine army over here, and they probably were standing there shaking their head. And I'm pretty sure when Saul said, "Go and the Lord be with you," he really meant that, because, you know, that is, you'll see an underdog give it a try. It's like, you poor guy, you're going to need all the help you can get. And, but they couldn't see. They couldn't see what David could see. So he walked out there, and instantly he was cursed and taunted by the giant. But he confidently met the challenge. And then in verse 45, the cause, again, is clear. The end there says, "But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." There it is again. David brought that clear. Every time he talked to somebody, the cause was clear in his mind, exactly what needed to be done and exactly why he was doing it. Because he had defied the army of God, the living God. He says, "I am come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, whom thou hast defied, and now you're going to die." To put it in short, Goliath there thought it was in the bag. David knew it was in the bag. He knew it was going to happen. And then on down, in verse 46, I like the way he says that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. His purpose, that the earth may know that there was a God in Israel. We fight these battles, and there's a lot of battles we'll face that you may face alone or you may face with an audience, but it comes clear when the battle is fought and won by both armies. That all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. That there is spectators, and we need to be aware of that. We're not in it alone. And one other thing I want to bring out here is, notice how thorough David was. Goliath, he slung the stone and Goliath went down. But he didn't raise his arms in victory quite yet. He ran up there and he stood on him and he pulled his sword out. He cut his head off. He didn't quit until he was 100% sure that Goliath was not going to move again. And then he celebrated. And then the armies understood that Goliath wasn't going anywhere. And I had to think of the emotions that must have been going through Eliab and King Saul as they stood back there and watched all that take place. What must have went through their mind? And just like so many times, it happens. Somebody fights a battle and wins and succeeds, and all the pandering, fearful people watching on when there's a victory get a whole bunch of bravery all of a sudden and want to be part of the battle. It was then that Eliab and Saul and all of Israel chased after the Philistines. Well, the battle was over. And that's a lot of times the way it works. People go from sarcastic to skeptical. All of a sudden they're paying attention because they understand that maybe something might be going on that they're not seeing. And then all of a sudden they want to be on the bandwagon because And that's just a lot of times how it goes. When a victory is secured, all of a sudden there's all kinds of help. So this morning I ask, sorry, I'm running over time here, honey. I just want to ask briefly, where are you in this? Are you Saul? Are you Eliab? Or are you David? Are you a defeated, pandering leader, whether it's in your home or in your church, or in any leadership role? Or are you Eliab, that looks just right, you got all the armor, you're part of the army or the church, but you lack the vision and you lack the cause in your mind that motivates you to make a difference? It's way easier just to sit back because everybody else is, and just wait for somebody else to move. And you have your armor and your, anyway, you can put a lot of confidence in that. But here David came in, or are you David? You come in, you perceive, you use what's at hand, you trust in the God of heaven because you see the cause and you fight that battle with what's at hand. The earth is overwhelmed with giants, and I'm not going to even go down on the new, you know what they are, a lot of them. What are we going to do? How are we relating to it? And it's, as we grow and as we mature, are we given the tools? Is a vision passed on to us that is going to carry us through the battles that we're going to face? I guess I see so many in Christian churches or in general that just will not stand up and make a difference because of what it'll cost them. And I see young men, middle-aged men, old men that hide behind their cloak of being a Mennonite or a Christian or a whatever it is. And that's all that happens. They don't ever move beyond that. And I guess the burden I have is, what are we doing? How am I relating to it? Am I seeing the vision? Am I passing that vision on to my children? So let's let the cause of Christ prevail in all that we do. He is there, and he is very real, and so are the giants. You will face them. That is just the way it is. An easy life, going back to the military, they put those soldiers through rigorous training. It's not, they don't give them everything they need. They want to make them improvise. They want to make them think. They want to make them think out of the box and move. But the only reason that they can take them to the point of giving their life and shedding their blood on the battlefield is that they have a vision in their mind that propels them on. And it's no different for us today.